Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
You have found us. Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Great guest this week. Excited to have Mary Tedesco on the show. She is one of the hosts of Genealogy Roadshow, and the new season has begun. And we're going to get caught up on what cities they're visiting this year, maybe get a little hint of some of the stories that they're going to share with us through the course of the season. Good stuff coming up in about 9 minutes. And then later on in the show, we're going to have Paul Woodbury back. You may recall he's a DNA expert. And just a week or so ago, I had a little breakthrough after, only 30-some-odd years. And as a result of that breakthrough, I added the names of some ancestors to my tree and wound up with a DNA match to the ancestors that I had connected to. Now, the question is, how significant is a DNA match when you get back to, say, a sixth great grandparent level? Does it really make a difference in solidifying your research? We're going to find out about that from Paul later on in the show. But right now it's time to head out to Boston, Massachusetts, and my good friend David Allen Lambert, the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org. David, how are you?
I am doing great. It's a nice sunny day here in Beantown, and I'll tell you, spring has definitely finally sprung. There's a lot of news in the world that, you know, kind of want to change the channel, and it's kind of sad and depressing. But I must say that the most heart-wrenching story in the longest time, with a historical twist, I don't know if you heard about Sid Schaffner. He's 94 and who is part of the American Army that went in and liberated over 30,000 Holocaust prisoners from Dachau concentration camp in southern Germany in 1945.
Yes.
Well, this story is amazing. The video is online where he meets with a 90-year-old gentleman by the name of Marcel Levy. Marcel was only 17 at the time. And he embraces this American vet and tells him that he's basically responsible for him being alive, his children, his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren. I'll tell you the old saying, bring a tear to a glass eye. This one is definitely worth the watch.
And, yes, I agree.
Being a child of a World War II veteran, I know the emotion attachment we have with this generation that we're losing more and more every day. But this is just a really great story. And I want to tell you, the next time that you go out to get your hair cut, save a few strands of it, because it might be worth some money someday.
What?
Yeah, well, I don't know if you heard, Thomas Jefferson, when he passed away, 14 strands of the former president's hair were saved by the doctor, and these were just sold off at auction for $7,000, which comes down to about $500 per strand.
$500 a strand. You know, it's a shame, too, because unless they pulled it out through the roots, there's no DNA to be had from that hair. As
and
I understand
that's a shame
it.
Because he was dead. It probably wouldn't have hurt very much.
No, exactly.
Getting back to veterans again, I couldn't let this go by without wishing a happy 110th birthday to America's oldest veteran, Richard Overton, who actually attributes his longevity to his chain-smoking cigars, a splash of whiskey in his morning coffee, and a steady diet of catfish butter pecan ice cream.
I'll tell you,
I would say that I could live off of butter pecan ice cream. Catfish isn't bad. Don't smoke cigars. I'm not much of a drinker. But I'll tell you, something's working for him. This veteran was with the 1887th Engineer Aviation Battalion in World War II. This all-black military unit started up in 1942, and he was stationed as a corporal in Hawaii, Guam, and Iwo Jima, and he was a skilled sharpshooter. So, happy birthday, Mr. Overton. Many more.
Wow.
Well, you know, digging into history is one of my loves. I love genealogy and I love archaeology. And I think, you know, we dig deep enough, we'll find our ancestors one way or the other.
It ties in.
It really does. And while they were building a train station extension over in Italy, they found an old Roman barracks.
Wow.
Right near the Colosseum. And it housed Hadrian's Praetorian Guard. And it's over a 100-meter hallway with over 39 rooms and many of them with detailed Roman mosaic floors. And that's amazing to think that it's just been there all that time.
That is absolutely incredible.
Well, you know, speaking of things that have been there all that time, I was going through some of my late father's belongings, and I happened to cross a school photograph. And Dad, unfortunately, wasn't archivally minded, if you will. The edges of it have silver masking tape. The to hold it together. And this group picture, it's in great shape, except for the picture of good old George Lambert, who has a circle and pencil around his head because he wanted to mark where he was probably when he was a child. I love school pictures. It's the only one I have. My dad, in fact, is the only one of two pictures I have of him as a child. You must have some of your mom and dad that you've come across.
Oh, well, absolutely. And it's interesting because a few weeks ago, you brought up reaching out to schools to see if they had old yearbooks.
Correct.
And I did this, and I actually called my dad's elementary school, which is still an elementary school in Bogota, New Jersey. It was actually built in 1909, I think. And so I called to ask how old their pictures might be that they had or yearbooks, and they said, oh, they didn't have anything like that. I said, well, you know, I've got pictures of my dad's classes from Bogota from the early to mid-20s, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. The third grade picture is actually marked with the names of all the classmates. She said, oh, could you scan those and send them to us? And so we did. And I just heard back from them that they're setting it up as a display at the school. So hopefully some of the descendants of some of these kids will get to see their parents in these photographs from way back 90 some odd years ago.
That's really great. I mean, it just kind of leads to the tech tip. If you have school photographs from when you were a kid, identify the people in the picture, because you never know. You could be giving a genealogical clue to somebody down the road. I mean, many of the ones with me back in the 70s and the 80s, I know who they are. Will my kids know? No.
That's right. All right, David, thanks so much. We'll talk to you again next week.
Take care, my friend.
All right, and later on the show, we're talking about DNA, the significance of DNA matches. How much do they matter when you get far back? And coming up next, we talk to Mary Tedesco from Genealogy Roadshow on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show on ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And I'm very excited. It's the first time I've gotten Mary Tedesco to come on the show. And she is, of course, one of the hosts of Genealogy Roadshow.
It's a pleasure to be here and on my second season of this wonderful show, Genealogy Roadshow.
Well, for those who aren't familiar with it, Mary, fill people in on what you do and how it works, because it's a great program.
Great. So I'm one of the three hosts of Genealogy Roadshow, along with, of course, Kenyatta Berry and Joshua Taylor, which I'm sure that everybody knows. Well, Genealogy Roadshow, Fish, is the acclaimed PBS TV series that features participants from around the country with unique family claims and histories. So we also get to have a lot of fun researching these, along with our research team in collaboration with our producers. It's just a really great time. We have a great season in store for you. I know many of your viewers probably saw the episode last Tuesday. We have another great one for you this week.
Right. Now, you were in Albuquerque last week, and right. You're off to, what is it, Miami this week?
Sunny Miami.
Tough work. I worked in Miami at one time in my life, and it is a lovely place.
It was a fantastic place, rich with culture. We have some great stories for you this week, Fish. One of my stories, a lady came to us, and she wanted to know whether she was related to Pocahontas, just to give you an example.
Ah, and was it a DNA thing, or how did this work?
Well, Fish, I can't tell you how we did it yet.
You're holding back on me. You're holding back on me. Come on, give me something. Throw me a bone, Mary.
Just a little bit. Well, let's just say that other folks that may have similar claims to Pocahontas or another historical figure may be able to benefit from this in terms of research technique and other things. And is this Florida woman related to Pocahontas? Well, we got to tune in on Tuesday.
That sounds like an interesting episode. You know, that's the thing that's so fun about genealogy is it doesn't matter if it's your ancestor or not, because you can relate A to the stories, and then you can learn from the research techniques to apply to your own efforts.
Exactly. As a host on the show, Genealogy Roadshow, I learn a lot about new documents myself, because as genealogists, we're always learning. And we hope, of course, that the folks at home can also benefit from seeing new document types or new research techniques or different ethnic groups. It really rounds us out and makes us all better genealogists, which is something that I really love about the show.
Yeah, absolutely. And we feel that here, too. A lot of people benefit from the stories of other people's ancestors on Extreme Genes, and it's a lot of fun. So do you actually ever get involved with DNA testing on Genealogy Roadshow?
Yes, Fish. So some of our stories this season and in past seasons do incorporate DNA into the stories and sometimes use it as a technique to solve the family mystery at hand.
I'm really looking forward to seeing the show. What other cities are you in this year?
In this season, we're in Albuquerque, of course, as you saw, Miami this coming week, Houston, Boston, Providence, Los Angeles, and we have an episode fish with some of our favorite stories from the past couple of seasons.
That sounds great. You're going to be all over the place.
Coast to coast fish, just like we like it.
Let's talk about how you got in the show, Mary. This is an unusual thing. I mean, you're a genealogist, as are Kenyatta and Josh. What brought this whole thing together, and how did you become a part of it?
It's a great story, actually. So the first season, of course, as folks know, there were two hosts, Josh Taylor and Kenyatta Berry. So for the third season, they were looking for a third host to be part of the show. And I'm very honored and flattered, of course, to say that Josh and Kenyatta recommended my name to interview to be a part of the show. So basically, I auditioned for producers and PBS executives, and I was invited to join the show as one of the three hosts. And not a day goes by that I don't realize and understand what a wonderful decision that was. And I've never looked back. It's been a great experience and a pleasure, to be honest.
Boy, what a great opportunity for you. That's right. Now, you're an Italian specialist in your research.
Correct.
Tell us a little about that.
That's correct. So, Fish, I run a research firm called Origins Italy. Now, we specialize in Italian and Italian-American genealogical research. So we deal with cases like dual citizenship, like folks needing documents or assistance getting dual citizenship. And also, we really include in-depth Italian-American and Italian research projects. And what I mean by in-depth, Fish, is that we go on site to Italy and we get to the bottom of the story. We not only concern ourselves with names and dates, but we dig into other records like notary records, military records, et cetera, to really paint a full picture of your ancestors. So it's a pretty unique approach, but we try to go so far beyond names and dates to really tell the whole story, something that I'm so excited about.
You know, that's really true. If you don't get the stories, then you really can't know the ancestor, and you can't love them. That's the bottom line,
exactly.
Right? There's no relationship to be had with just a name and a date. You have to dig. How long have you been doing this?
So I first got exposed to genealogy just about 10 years ago when a colleague loaned me a login to a big name genealogy site. Now, of course, I've since gotten my own login.
Well, that's good.
After that, I need to preface the story by that. And then I was exposed to these early records in my research, like passenger lists for my grandparents, that really inspired me, Fish, to want to know more, to explore more. And at the time, 10 years ago, there weren't a lot of resources for Italian genealogy. So I was self-taught, and I went out there. I went to Italy to dig up records on my ancestors, which is a great way to learn.
Isn't that funny how we'll go about this work, you know, which so involves helping other people learn how to find their roots and dig up these stories. And then when we want to take a break, we research our own, doing exactly the same thing as a respite.
Exactly. Those of us whose passion is also their profession have got to keep ourselves in check, because it's really easy to just get carried away. And I know you and I were talking about that on the phone recently. But when we get fixated on an ancestor, we cannot stop. You know, we genealogists are up until 2 or 3 in the morning trying to track down an ancestor. Pretty normal stuff, I would say, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. My wife was out of town visiting grandkids in Nebraska, and we were having rain all through a weekend. So I was just, it was great. The cat was away.
Right, right. And the mice, they danced, to use the Italian expression.
Yeah, it was a great time. All right, so let's talk about some of the things you found in Italy and what people could actually expect to find if they went over there and attempted to do some of the things you're doing.
So the church and the city hall are great places to delve into your Italian genealogical research first. Now, at the city hall, you can find birth, marriage, and death records, and also some demographics records. And you can write to the city hall from home, from Italy. You can start tonight from your pajamas, which is pretty exciting.
Nice. Now, by the way, how far back do those birth, death, and marriages typically go?
So it really depends, Fish, on where your family is from in Italy. So, for example, in Calabria, which is in southern Italy, where my grandfather is from, civil records start in the early, early part of the 1800s. Whereas if you're up in Rome, for example, Italian civil registration would start in 1871 when that area became part of Italy. So you have to look to history first, Fish, in order to determine where those records begin. So before civil registration, there's also church records, which could take your family back into the 17th, 16th, or even 1500s.
Wow. And that's typical.
That is pretty typical. Now, of course, there are records that are missing, that were destroyed either by natural disaster or war. But until you have that information that's missing, you can assume it's there and then, of course, confirm with an email or a phone call to that local repository. And I'm sure they'll be able to clear that up for you.
Well, and of course, anytime you take a genealogical trip, you got to do your homework beforehand, because your real currency on a trip is time. And
Exactly. You
want to spend as much of it at home first, getting ready and figuring out where you're going to go and what you're really looking for and trying to accomplish some of that before you get there. You talked about a lot of the stories that come out of the records. What other records might yield some great fruit?
So some other records in Italy to be aware of are notary records, which could usually be found at the Archivi di Stato system. Notary records could have things like marriage contracts between a couple or land transactions, things to help you paint a picture of the socioeconomic status of your family. You can also find military records, which are great. Now, fish on military records, Italian military records, you can find potentially a physical description of your ancestor, including height, hair color, nose, etc. It's pretty fascinating thing.
Okay, Mary, so you know that anytime somebody comes on the show, they got to have one killer story for us. So what's yours?
So growing up, my beloved grandmother often spoke about her father, Mario, and he was from Trentino in Alto Adige in northern Italy. So my grandmother mentioned many, many times that her father was very handsome, very tall, over 6 feet. Photographs seem to confirm this fish. She also said that he served in World War I for the Austro-Hungarian Army. Now, remember, Northern Italy, this part of Northern Italy was part of Austria at the time. So I said, I'm a genealogist. I need to go and prove this. I need to see how tall, you know, Nonno Mario actually was. So I tracked down my great-grandfather's military records from Innsbruck, Austria, and discovered that he was, how tall? Just 5'5" fish.
5'5"? Okay. Well, no wonder he survived. Nobody's going to hit that little guy.
Exactly. So I brought this information home. I reported it to my family members, and my grandmother, in her classic Italian accent, was like, oh, really? He seemed a lot taller to me.
I love it.
I still have an aunt fish that doesn't believe this, you know, and I've shown her the original record. She says, well, it might be wrong, you know.
Right.
Such is the power of family lore.
Yes, such is the power of family lore. Yeah, that can't be right, you know, because my aunt told
me.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Mary Tedesco, it's been a delight having you on.
Thank you so much, Fish. It's been a sincere pleasure to be on.
And coming up next, it's a personal story about a breakthrough on one of my lines and a DNA match that may confirm it. But how reliable is that match? We'll talk to DNA expert Paul Woodbury next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. In the course of your research, you have had a DNA match. How significant is that really? Hi, it's Fisher, the Radio Root Sleuth on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. And I just had a breakthrough a couple of weeks ago. My wife was out of town. I stayed up late, just researching in my underwear till the middle of the night on a sixth great grandparent, somebody had had a long struggle with. She had married her husband in Vermont in 1765. And the question was, where did she come from? Whose family did she belong to? She died at age 77 in 1816, late 1816, pretty much placing her directly into 1739 as a birth date. Well, there was only one person named Olive Hill, born in 1739 in that area. And she was born to Asa Hill and his wife, Sarah, in Sherborne, Massachusetts, way to the east, the eastern side of Massachusetts, 161 miles away from Pownall, Vermont, where my Olive Hill married her husband, Josiah Noble. So I had a real difficult time saying, well, this must be the same person, because how do you get them in the same neighborhood, at least, to get married? Well, a little traditional research yielded that Asa started moving west. He fought in the French and Indian War. He was wounded. He escaped from a fort. I mean, all kinds of great military stories going on there. And as a result, he was awarded a land grant for 200 acres in what they now call the Berkshires, Washington, Massachusetts. And that actually took him and placed him and his family halfway between Olive Hill's husband, where he was from in Southwick, Massachusetts, and Pownall, Vermont. She was now just 30 miles away. And so it seemed to me pretty obvious when you look at the population charts from back around 1739 when she was born. There were only 900,000 people in the entire country at that time, which is roughly the population of Delaware today. So I put this father and mother combination onto the chart as parents of Olive Hill and some grandparents and the like, just to see what would happen with DNA matches. And wouldn't you know it, a few days later, in came a DNA match for a seventh cousin under Asa Hill, the father, Asa and Sarah. And so the question came up, well, how significant is this in proving that this is the correct relationship? So that's why I wanted to get my good friend Paul Woodbury on. He's a DNA analyst for LegacyTree.com. Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Scott.
I was going through all the math here over the weekend, spent a lot of time mapping out how this works. And I guess it's kind of interesting when it comes to DNA matches. When we start out the first four or five generations, there aren't that many couples. For instance, my second grades, we all have eight second great grandparent couples, right?
Exactly.
And I placed mine, the average time of birth, somewhere around 1815. So roughly I'm thinking, okay, 9 million people in the country at that time. But some of my couples may not have been born within the country, right? And, of course, of the 9 million people in America in 1815, only some of them lived in the area that my people were from. So the bottom line, though, if you had a DNA match for one of your eight second great grandparent couples, that's pretty significant because it's a very small number of couples out of a very, very large population. As you go back, of course, we see this thing double every generation until you get to what I've been talking about. 128 couples at the sixth great-grandparent level. So the odds of actually finding a match get better and better the further you go back, except that we all don't inherit the same DNA from the same ancestors. And some ancestors, we don't get any DNA at all, right?
Exactly.
So the question is, how significant is this DNA match that I found in confirming the paper research that I've done?
Well, I think the key in this is that you are incorporating this DNA match as part of your traditional genealogical research, that it's you're using it to confirm information that you've been able to ascertain through your own traditional research. It's important that as we're evaluating some of these more distant cousins and some of these more distant matches, that we need to evaluate their entire family trees for other possible origins of that shared DNA. Another element that you mentioned briefly is that eventually there will be a point in our own family trees where we will not have inherited significant amounts of DNA from many of our own ancestors.
Right.
We kind of call it the difference between genetic trees versus genealogical trees. And at the point around 7 to 8 generations is where your ancestors begin to fall off of your genetic tree. Around 10 generations, you're only going to inherit significant portions of your DNA from about half of your ancestors. So it's important as you're evaluating some of these more distant matches that you also make sure that you have genetic matches for the intervening generation.
I guess the idea is what you're saying is it helps to prove that there is some DNA flowing from that far back, right? Because we don't obtain DNA from everybody.
Yeah, and DNA is not going to skip generations.
Right. Good point. So it's amazing, though, when you crunch the numbers on this, I mean, what the population of our country was back in the day, like in 1650, we had all of 50,000 people here. That's about the population of today's Northern Marianas Islands. In 1740, we had what is today the population of Delaware. And in 1770, just before the Revolution, 2.1 million, which is today's population of New Mexico. So, you know, really small populations, but they're spread out. So we're not even dealing with populations that large. And then, of course, many of the people in the population at that time were children, or single individuals, or even couples that didn't have children, right?
Exactly. And so because of that, we really want to make sure that we analyze all of the entire tree for each match to make sure that they don't have other lines of their ancestry from the same small pockets of populations, so that we can lend greater credence to the fact that this common ancestral couple that we have identified for this distant cousin is most likely the common source of that shared DNA.
Right. Only in the most recent generations, going back to, say, second, maybe third great grandparents, are those DNA matches exceptionally significant. Yes?
Yes.
When you go back beyond that, then it gets more and more challenging to really place significance on it.
Yeah, and part of the challenge of that is that with the closer generations, we have distinct levels of DNA sharing that we expect for different levels of relationship. But once you get back to the level of fourth cousin to fifth cousin, sixth, seventh, eighth cousin, you know, an eighth cousin may have exactly the same chance of sharing any given amount of DNA as a fourth cousin. And so it's a little bit harder to say, yes, this is the common ancestral couple that gave us this DNA.
Yeah, it's fascinating to try to put this all together and figure out, okay, here's a person who shares some DNA with me to some level, and we share this ancestor on this chart, but is that really important? Great insight as always, and always great to have you on the show.
And let me add before we go that these genetic cousins that are more distant can be significant for your research, but it may be necessary to identify additional cousins that are also shared in common that also have the same segments of DNA that you share in common. And if you don't have those, then it could be a good idea to begin searching out additional descendants of that ancestral couple to see how they fit into the known network of genetic cousins that you've already established.
He's DNA analyst Paul Woodbury from LegacyTree.com. Thanks. Great advice, Paul.
Thank you.
You gotta love the science of family history these days. Love that DNA. All right, coming up for you next, of course, preservation with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He's our preservation authority. And we're going to talk about the importance of knowing who your end users are going to be when you decide how you want to digitize your materials. It's going to save you a lot of money. So listen up. It's coming up on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It's Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, the radio root sleuth, and it is preservation time. Tom Perry, our preservation authority, is in the house. And Tom, we were just talking off the air here a few moments ago about people who come into your store and they don't really know the end game of what they're trying to do in terms of digitizing. And I'm sure this happens in places all over the country, and they wind up buying a Cadillac when really all they need is a Mini Cooper.
Oh, that is so true. I mean, it's like buying a car. A lot of times when you go to buy a car, they say how much you have to spend, not what are your needs. And we're just the opposite of that. We want to find out, you know, what somebody's needs are. And whether you send stuff to us, bring it into us, or use one of your local players, you need to, you know, be careful, because some people will charge you as much as they can get away with. And there's a lot of real good, honest people out there that will do what's right. But you want to make sure what, like you use the word end game is going to be. And that's a perfect word. What do you ultimately want to do with all your slides, your photos, your old reel-to-reel audio, your film, video, all these kind of things? What do you want to do with them? Let me give you an example. We had a gentleman come in the other day that had, probably about 2 or 3 dozen VHS tapes, and he wanted them all on Blu-ray. Blu-ray is a little bit more expensive to do than DVD and MP4s. And so we tried talking him out of it, say, hey, you know, we're happy to do Blu-rays for you if that's what you want. However, you know, DVDs are going to be just as good, because when you're working with something that's already electronic, like a videotape or an audio tape, whether you go to Blu-ray, whether you go to MP4s, whether you go to DVD, whatever, it's not going to change your content. The only reason you'd go to a Blu-ray is because you want to go to Blu-ray. There's no reason for it. If you go with DVD, you accomplish several things. It's going to cost you less. They're going to be done faster. They're going to be more compatible with friends and neighbors and, you know, relatives that you're going to send them off to, and you're not gaining anything at all. And some people say, oh, well, yeah, Blu-rays have the ability to play better. That's true. However, if you have a Blu-ray player and you play a DVD in it, most Blu-ray players will up-convert your videos anyway. So if you have, whether it's an old Disney DVD, whether it's a VHS you've turned into a DVD, if you play it in a Blu-ray player, it's going to actually look better than if you played it in your old DVD player just by, you know, the up-conversion that it does for you naturally. So, I mean, if somebody says, no, I want Blu-ray, period, that's fine. However, we want to educate people and let them know you might not need Blu-ray. So if your only interest is to get your VHS or whatever, I'm sure you use VHS as a generic term almost, to get your items preserved, if you're just going to want to email them to people, you're not going to want to make a whole bunch of copies, then I'd suggest you go to MP3s or MP4s because they're small enough, but they're really good quality that you can actually post them on your Facebook page. You can put them in Dropbox or whatever kind of cloud device you want to use and give people the link to it. You can actually email them. They're small enough. And so then they have the access to them immediately. They don't have to wait for the disc. Some people, you know, want to actually have a physical disc, and that's fine. A lot of the, you know, older generation, they want to have that physical disc. They don't understand what I download this to, you know, my thumb drive, and I plug my thumb drive into my TV. They don't understand that. But if everybody in your family understands technology, just go with MP3s or MP4s. And it's always nice to have a backup as a CD or a DVD, because as we say on almost every show, we always recommend you have everything, all your memories backed up on a disc, whether it's DVD or CD or an M disc or Blu-ray. You have it on your hard drive and then in one or two clouds, whether you use Google Cloud, whether you use Lightjar, whether you use Dropbox, it doesn't matter. You want to get it up in at least one cloud and possibly two. And if you don't have a ton of stuff, you can usually get their free ones. It's good, you know, for so many, like maybe a terabyte or such. And if you have a whole bunch, it's not that much more expensive. I mean, we use tons and tons of that. And, you know, we pay $100 a month for, you know, a lot of stuff.
How do people determine what their end use is?
The best thing is to listen to our shows, and especially since they're searchable now with the PDFs, you can go in and type in a topic and possibly find one of our episodes where we've addressed something. Another way to do it is, even if you want to stay local, that's fine. We're here to help you in any way we can. Just send your questions to asktom@tmcplace.com and say, this is what I have. This is what my end use is. What should I do? And we'll let you know. And if you want to take it to a local place, you know, that's great. We actually want people to support their local people. But if you want to send it to us, we're happy to work with you as well. So basically, let's talk about what we call boxes. Whether you're talking about MP3s, MP4s, DVDs, CDs, Blu-ray, M-Disc, Blu-ray, M-Disc, all these different things, look at them as different size of luggage or boxes, because they all pretty much can do the same thing. For instance, a thumb drive doesn't care what kind of data you put on it.
Right.
You can put audio, you can put video, you can put, you know, actually video games, whatever you want to put on it. But so you need to understand what you want. The majority of the time when you want audio, like old reel-to-reel tapes or cassette tapes or dictaphone or whatever you have, we usually transfer those to CD and MP3s. Because the CDs, you have that physical thing you can save and put away. You've got your MP3s you can put on your iPhone, your Android, whatever you want. If you have video, then we suggest MP4 and DVD. So again, you've got the physical disc to hold.
Right.
But then you also have an MP4 that's on a flash drive. You can email them. You can distribute them any way you want, real easy. Then the next step up, you're looking at, which we've mentioned, DVDs and CDs. You can put audio on a DVD. You can put video on a CD. You're just limited with the size of the box. So most people, when they say DVD, they're thinking video. When you're saying CD, you're thinking audio.
Yes.
So when we're doing slides and photos, we usually do those as JPEGs or TIFFs. And so we can put them on a CD. We can put them on a thumb drive. You can put them on a DVD. And the only thing that determines what we put on them is how much stuff you have.
Sure.
You know, like if you've got a 2,000 square foot house, you know, 100 square foot carpet isn't going to fill your house. If you have a 200 square foot house, 1,000 feet of carpet is overkill. You need to know what you need. You'll need a DVD with four pictures on it, because the problem is you're not filling the whole disc and say, well, so what? They're not that much more expensive. However, if somebody you're going with only has access to a CD reader, they're not going to be able to play your DVD. So you want to check on that. And then Blu-rays are awesome. They're a good way to store stuff. You can get almost twice as much on a DVD. Plus, there's several sizes of Blu-rays. You can get, you know, ones that are 2.5 terabytes. You can get all different sizes. So you figure out what my needs are. Don't buy the dump truck if all you need is a, you know, RAM pickup.
So not to confuse people, though, when you talked earlier about if you don't need a Blu-ray, don't pay $5 extra for it. That's because it's a different purpose.
Exactly. The only time you absolutely positively want to go with Blu-ray is if you're using something optical. Like we talked earlier about magnetic with VHS tapes, it's no difference. If it's magnetic, DVD 9 out of 10 times is going to be fine for you. And then they also have Blu-ray M discs now.
I still think that's the best way to describe all these storage devices, Tom, like little boxes or big boxes. Thanks so much for coming on.
Good you've been here.
I cannot believe we are done for another week. Thanks once again to Mary Tedesco from the PBS series Genealogy Roadshow. They're back for a third season right now. You can catch it Tuesday nights. Check your local listings for times. And by the way, if you wanted to catch some of the things Mary had to say about Italian research, make sure you check out the podcast through iTunes and iHeartRadio and ExtremeGenes.com. Thanks also to Paul Woodbury, the DNA expert from LegacyTree.com, for coming on and talking about the significance of DNA matches for ancestors further back than 200 years. You'll love to hear what he has to say. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Talk to you next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.